are some of the ways that you have approached doing this? What are some helpful tips that you might be able to give to those, especially working within a foundation?
Sure. The first thing is, in talking to boards about this or new board members, just acknowledging that it does feel intrusive. Typically, if you're talking about the founder or the donor family, they're living, they're used to, because they have complex financial lives, they're not surprised that they're asked questions. They're asked questions on the SEC side. There's a lot of different disclosures they have to make. But what happens is you professionalize the foundation board, and then you bring on a Nobel laureate, or you bring on other folks who are from different contexts. They're a little surprised that you are effectively asking them for kind of a mini family tree, both of their actual family and also of their business relationships, especially people coming out of the academy or sometimes out of the health side of things. So building that into whether it's your board recruitment, or we'll probably end up talking, or we've heard a lot at this conference about some of the new structures, when you go through a reorganization or when you create a new structure, just making this part of that initial orientation, and then as part of your annual conflict of interest process, build that into it. It also, that you can add it to your checklist when you have particularly large transactions. You can say, well, we're selling this piece of property to a neighbor, and it's some sort of consortium. We might at this moment want to go back and make sure that we've asked the question of all the folks who could potentially be investors in that. Now, of course, it gets even more complicated the more complex the financial lives of your board and your committee members are, but that's the approach I've seen taken.
And so I know as a practitioner, we're always telling our foundations that we work with, you need to constantly keep up with your disqualified person list. You need to have that up to date all the time. But realistically or practically, how often or how frequently would you, you know, approach that, other than special situations? You have a new board member, you have a new transaction.
I think on the annual basis is what I've seen done. But again, if you know there's kind of situations that are coming up, that's where you want to make sure that you as counsel or as the tax professional are just putting it back on people's radar. We need to ask this. I think the challenge is most people don't even have a great annual process in place. They sort of a thought that somehow this is, we'll get to that if we need to. And it actually goes to one of the next questions we had, right? Which was about how do we manage an inadvertent prohibited transaction? And of course, I guess the lead into that is a way to have an inadvertent prohibited transaction. For example, in this case, they said a sale of an asset to a disqualified person is unfortunately not to have a strong process in place there for surfacing that. So I don't know if maybe I'll turn back to you to say, I think as we were talking, you'd seen some more egregious examples of having to unwind, but that's the headline, right, for a self-dealing transaction, and you have to unwind it, you have to correct it, and you have to sort of do it immediately.
Right. When you have a self-dealing transaction, one of the difficulties is a lot of times they're inadvertent. You don't know that it's occurred, and it's not uncovered until you're closing the books, you're doing the audit, you're preparing to do the tax return the next year. And one of the more sinister portions of the self-dealing provisions is that many of the self-dealing transactions listed in the regulations are deemed to recur at the beginning of every tax year that it has not been corrected. So going back to what Lauren said, that as soon as you identify that you have a self-dealing transaction, you need to work with that disqualified person to get it corrected as soon as possible. And we can't emphasize the ASAP part of that as soon as possible enough, because if you have a transaction, for example, that occurred in 2017, you realize it in 2018 and you get it corrected in 2018, the way that the regulations work in certain situations is that they compound. So you have that self-dealing transaction that occurred in 2017. You're going to have to file the 4720 and pay the 10% excise tax on it. In 2018, as of 1/1/2018, you're deemed to incur a second self-dealing transaction. And so you have a new transaction in 2018. It's really the same one that occurred in 17, but because you didn't fix it, it's recurring again in 2018. And so then you have to file the 4720, not only because the transaction didn't get corrected from 17 and report in 2018, you also then have to report what's deemed to be the new transaction in 2018. So you're compounding that 10% and you've got multiple transactions you're reporting in the next year, which end up being, you know, roughly 20%. Another point to raise, too, is that when you do file the 4720, one of the first or second questions asked in the very first box of the 4720 is, did you correct this transaction? If so, what amount was paid back to the foundation, and provide details? And if you answer that question no, or if you leave it blank and file that 4720, I can guarantee that the IRS is going to come knocking on your door. And hopefully you've got some kind agents that will simply say, hey, you forgot to give us some information, wink, wink, did you correct this? Because it could technically close the taxable period. And you could be looking at second-tier taxes, which are 200% of the transaction. Now, I've never seen the IRS assess the second tier, but it's critical to understand, not only is it important to correct so that you reduce that compounding effect, but to correct so that when you're filing, you don't have any issues with the IRS coming back. You want to have a clean form, just put it in and pay it, and move on.
I'm curious to ask the audience, and again, not for the folks who are at foundations, but for the outside advisors, has anyone, and I see Jody may have an answer here, has anyone actually seen that 200%, that second tier tax imposed?